And thank you for joining us here on The Collector Show on Web Talk Radio. I am Harold Nickel, back for another week of conversations about collecting. This week on The Collector Show, we are going to be joined by a man whose name is Barry Levinson. Now, those of you who listened to the show a few years back may remember Barry. He is the founder, curator, and chief mustard officer of the National Mustard Museum. He'll join us in the interview segment of the program. And then, of course, our friend Larry Zale from Visual Arts Advisory Services also joins us with some of his views and opinions about collecting. But first, as always, here is just some of the news from the world of collecting. A lot of you may know about the Robotech series. Well, it's been cartoons and TV shows, movies, books, and now there will be a 20-disc Robotech DVD collection. It's going to be released on the 5th of November. Remember, Robotech on the 5th of November. Finalized pricing information isn't available just yet, but there's plenty of technical details that the manufacturers have announced, including some new and never-before-released documentaries about the show. The complete set includes the remastered versions of all 85 episodes from the three Robotech Wars, the Robotech Masters, and the New Generation. It also includes Robotech 2 movie collection featuring the fan favorite Shadow Chronicles and their latest film, Love Live Alive, oh man, as well as a bonus disc. And you can take it all home on the 5th of November. By the way, if you go to the collectorshow.net website, you can read and link to all of these stories. You remember the card game Yu-Gi-Oh! From a few years back? Well, there's a company called Konami, and they've just announced a brand new Star Wars-centered card battling game. It's called Star Wars Force Collection. The game is going to feature more than 230 heroes, villains, and vehicles from all six episodes of Star Wars, which will be used to build decks. You'll use those completed decks to complete quests, participate in massive battle events, and there's even a light and a dark side. It's a big, big card game, and you have to have all of the sets to be able to participate in all of it. Again, a link to that on collectorsshow.net. A little more serious talk about collecting. There's a very important American pop art exhibition that's going to be opening in Tokyo, specifically at the National Art Center in Tokyo. It's one of the most comprehensive exhibitions of American pop art ever to be seen in Japan. Of course, American pop art was a reaction to mass production and consumption and even advertising after the end of the Second World War. And there were two collectors, John and Kamiko Powers, who started collecting art back in the 1960s. And though Mr. Powers passed away in 1999, his Mrs. has continued to carry on their collecting pursuits. Japan has a very unique connection to American pop culture because of the American occupation after the end of the Second World War. Baseball, among other things, very popular in Japan. But they also are very interested in our artwork, and the Powers have a very large collection of Jasper John's artwork. It will also be on display. They've got so much of Jasper John's work that Kamiko recently opened the Powers Art Center in Colorado, which according to her is dedicated to the study, display, and dissemination of prints by Jasper John's. And in addition to being an important modern artist, Jasper John's appeared on an episode of The Simpsons back in 1999 in an episode titled Mom and Pop Art. All right, car lovers, start your engines. There's a vehicle vault opening introducing the premier auto gallery and elite collector community that provides a unique environment for those who share a passion for cars. Set to break ground soon and be open to the public in September of 2014, Vehicle Vault is so much more than just a museum for cars. It provides a community and culture for motorsport enthusiasts to discuss and share ideas and experiences across motor sports. It's in Denver, or will be in Denver, and as we say, ground will break this year, and it'll be open to the public in 2014. And from the looks of it online, it looks like a very unique home for local and regional auto shows and car club events. I happen to know some people who are involved in an antique car club, and this is the kind of thing that they would dig. All right, and this is kind of a sad story. I don't know if this is a lesson in why you should insure your collectibles or possibly do a better job of just hiding them, but I think at some point we're going to have to do a segment on insuring collectibles, because we don't want anyone to experience the same thing that a man in Peoria, Illinois, did when his baseball card collection was stolen. This individual chose not to reveal his name because he was afraid that he would be targeted for more thefts, but he did tell the local newspaper, the Journal Star, that he had had over 200 mint condition baseball cards, including a 1969 Mickey Mantle, that were stolen from him. He had 50 Hall of Famers in his collection, and he had hid them in what he described as, quote, an unfindable spot. But what was unfortunate about this is that it looked as though whoever stole them knew exactly where to look. So he and his wife went on a vacation, and when they got home, they noticed a few things askew, and then he realized that somebody had been through his baseball cards. Nothing else in the home was taken, but about 150 cards were left, all of them of, average players, and they weren't really worth a lot. So the Hall of Fame cards, the Mantle card, Billy Williams, Harmon Killebrew, Al Kaline, the really successful ball players and valuable cards were missing. So I think for all of us who collect and who have things that we not only value because of their monetary worth, but we value them because of our emotional attachments to them, either insuring them or putting them in a safe deposit box or in some other type of better hiding place than this individual had, is good advice. All right, that's the news for the Collector Show for this week. And next, during the interview segment, how the most famous booted ground ball in the history of baseball derailed one man's career as an attorney general and led him to assemble the largest collection of mustard anywhere, next on the Collector Show. Well, in this segment of the Collector Show, we are joined by Barry Levinson, who is the founder, curator, and chief mustard officer of the National Mustard Museum. The museum is the home of the world's largest collection of mustard and is located in Middleton, Wisconsin. And Barry, welcome to the Collector Show.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Now, I know that in 1986 you had a life-changing event that really took your life in a new direction. Why don't you tell us about that?
It certainly did. At the time, I was an assistant attorney general for the state of Wisconsin. But on October 27, 1986, my beloved Red Sox, I'm from New England, so of course I'm a Red Sox fan. That year, that day, that night, they lost the World Series to the Mets, and I was devastated. They should have won in Game 6. People may remember the famous Bill Buckner error where the Red Sox were so close to winning it all. They lost Game 7 October 27th, and the following morning, unable to sleep, I went to an all-night grocery, roamed up and down the aisles, crying, looking for the meaning of life, and I was in front of the mustards when I heard a voice that said, "If you collect us, they will come."
So,
kind of like that anyway. But that is when I began collecting jars of mustard.
Well, it's a good story, and I assume that most of it's true. We all remember
most of it is true. Maybe not the voice, but it is absolutely true that at 2:30 a.m., because I remember checking my watch back in the days when we wore watches instead of looked at our cell phones, and I said, 2:30, I wonder if this will be a significant moment, because I purchased about 10 or 12 jars of mustard and said, I'm going to start collecting mustards. I didn't know what on earth I was doing and what would be in store for me.
Well, and that's kind of what I wonder is that was mustard something that you were interested in early in life? Did something happen or some sort of event that you associated with mustard that continued an interest in this, you know, Buckner missing the easiest ground ball ever just sort of triggered?
I don't think so. I mean, I certainly liked mustard as a kid growing up in Worcester. And I remember putting it on hot dogs. And I remember my friend Michael and I saying, oh, hiccups, take mustard. And I remember cooking with mustard as I got a little older. But I don't think it was something that was a big part of my life. I know it wasn't. It was something I took for granted, like most people.
Yeah, it's a complement to sandwiches and hot dogs and other kinds of things. But it doesn't, I guess, and the reason it's interesting is that it's not one of your more typical types of collections. And I never heard the one about hiccups and mustard. Tell me about that.
Well, my friend Michael, who was just my absolute best friend, we decided that whenever we got the hiccups, a tablespoon of mustard would take it away. I think it worked. I'm not sure, but that was the thing, that whenever one of us got the hiccups, the word mustard always came out next.
Huh. That's next time I have the hiccups, I'm going to try a spoonful of mustard. I'll let you know how it goes.
It can't hurt.
Yeah, so you're in a grocery store and you're grieving about the 86 World Series, and you picked up a handful or an armload of different types of mustard. Knowing what you know based on all these years of experience, what would you tell somebody who wanted to start a mustard collection now?
I would say keep walking. I don't know. It is fascinating because mustard, unlike ketchup and the other lesser condiments, does have a long history. And there is a lot to collect, and not just jars of mustard. There's tins, there's old mustard pots, old mustard ads, because mustard goes back centuries. But whether or not you want to, you know, do it as I do it, as a living now, I'd be really careful.
And we're going to get to that as we talk about how you made the move from Attorney General to CMO. But what I'm hearing you say is keep walking.
But that's, keep your day job, right?
Yeah, well, keep your job. But most people are just casual collectors, and most folks, in fact, the vast majority, are going to keep their day jobs. But let's just say you decided you wanted to begin your evenings and weekends collecting mustard. What are the kinds of gotta-haves in any starter's collection?
Well, certainly you want to have as many different jars of mustard that you can find. Now, we have over 5,500 in the collection, and that has taken over 22 years to do. But also, go to garage sales, go to antique sales, look for antique mustard tins, antique mustard pots, anything with the word mustard. I guess you can go on eBay. I certainly have been there before. There are a lot of things that involve the history of mustard, old mustard advertising. There's certainly plenty connected with mustard with which one can make a hobby of collecting.
Yeah, that was the thing. And when I looked at your website, I was very impressed as somebody who spent his career and spends his career in the ad business at the quality of the art that made up the advertisements and the illustrations. And I can easily see branching out from collecting mustard into collecting advertising and labels and jars as a to augment or supplement your mustard collection.
Well, certainly I know there are a lot of people who collect spice tins, mm-hmm. and there are certainly thousands of spice tins to be collected. We just have mustard tins, and we have over 400 of those.
Wow.
And, of course, that's it's a very gratifying activity, finding the old mustard spice tins. Now there are maybe 6 or 8 in the whole country being made, but it used to be that every region would have its glorious mustard tin with dry mustard in it.
So your collection is vast, your expertise likely unparalleled. If you looked at a mustard collection, whether it was for the art or for the types of mustard, what would you say distinguishes a good or valuable collection from one that's average?
Well, since I don't know really of any other ones, it's hard to compare. But I think what makes the collection here special is, number one, the breadth of it, the fact that so many countries are represented. We have mustards and mustard items from more than 80 countries.
Wow.
So I would certainly look at that, is what countries are represented. I would look at the kinds of articles that are in the collection. Is it just jars of mustard? Originally, for me, it was jars of mustard, mm-hmm. but we branched out into things having to do with mustard and its medicinal uses, so mustard plasters, mustard tins, old mustard ads, glass jars of mustard, old mustard advertising, anything to do with mustard. If there's anything that is related to mustard, it should be in a collection. Even if it may not be totally expansive and complete, that's fine. But you should represent just about everything that has something to do with mustard.
I want to talk to you just a little bit about mustard plaster. As a lifelong asthmatic, I've never understood what the potential value, therapeutic or otherwise, of mustard plaster or rubbing anything on the outside of your chest. What was the theory behind mustard plaster?
Well, it's the principle of counter-irritation, which is a well-accepted principle. It's also the same thing that takes place when you have Vicks VapoRub.
Mm-hmm.
And mustard plasters were really the precursor of Vicks VapoRub.
I have never until just now heard about counter-irritation. I'm going to look into that.
It's a well-accepted medical principle. Now, it's not commonly used, but there are parts of the world where mustard plasters are still being used. I know that they're still being applied in Russia, for example.
No kidding. Now, you had mentioned a moment ago that you weren't aware of anybody else that collects mustard, but you have to have run into somebody or a group of people someplace who share this interest with you. Do you have a yearly convention?
There are certainly people who have collections of mustard pots,
mm-hmm.
Or mustard tins. A few people collect jars of mustard, and there are a few kind of sister museums, but they're not at all like we are in terms of trying to showcase everything about mustard. We have a sister museum in Beaune, in the heart of Burgundy, in France, and there is kind of a company museum there. And we actually do work with them. We're very close with them. But that's pretty much it in terms of museums dedicated to mustard. There's a mustard mill in Maine, in Eastport, Maine, that I guess is in its own very charming way a museum in terms of how mustard is made. But in terms of showcasing mustard, the mustard experience all over the world, that would be us.
The mustard experience, I love that. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Barry Levinson, who's the curator of the National Mustard Museum, which is located in Middleton, Wisconsin. So I want to talk to you, shifting gears, about the decision to leave your regular job and pursue mustard full-time. How did the people around you, your family, your friends, what was their reaction to your decision?
It was actually three words. Are you crazy?
Yeah.
That was what it was. And, of course, they were right. I think especially if you have a job with great benefits and whatever, you know, you may want to think twice about that, three times, four times, maybe even five about it, because doing this for a living has been financially challenging. Although we get about 35,000 people a year coming through here, there's a gift shop. We have an online store, mustardmuseum.com, where you can also learn about mustard. But I think it takes a certain personality to put up with the ups and downs of having a small business. I'm not sure I always have it, although I guess I'm stubborn enough because I've been doing it now for more than 21 years.
Yeah, and I think what you just said is probably true of anyone who decides to leave a regular paycheck and go out on their own, is that, and you're a lawyer, That's a pretty good job. So I will.
It was a terrific job. It really was. I loved it. And people then will say, "Oh, it must be so much less stressful." No, it isn't. Running your own business and having to fend for yourself is a lot more stressful. Yeah, I did criminal cases, first-degree murder cases, whatever. You know, you do your best, you win, you lose, and you still get a paycheck.
Yeah, I...
And health insurance and all those other good things.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, along with having an interest in something that really drives you, I think it takes a lot of courage to essentially invent the job of chief mustard officer. That's pretty cool. And I was reading an article about the people who are the most satisfied with their lives, and it said that the people who were most satisfied were the ones who took the most risks, not necessarily the ones who had the most money or the highest levels of comfort. And when I hear you talk and when I look at your website and so forth, I get an appreciation not just for the fact that this was risky and took a lot of courage, but it sounds like fun.
It is. It is a lot of fun, and it's great sharing this. I've written a book called Mustard on a Pickle. It's a children's book, and it is so much fun to have a child sit down and read it and then come back later and recite the whole book by memory.
Oh, my
gosh. So many of them have done that. So it's just wonderful. I mean, you can't put a price on something like that.
I would have to agree. You're a talented guy, Barry. You're a lawyer. You're a children's author. You're a museum curator. In putting together the displays at the museum, what are the most popular, or what is the most popular attraction?
Well, I have a couple of things. One that's probably the most popular and photographed, we have the original French's mustard mascot.
Oh, wow.
And it's life-size, and it sits right at the bottom of the stairs when you walk down into the museum. And I can't tell you the hundreds, if not thousands, of pictures that have been taken with Frenchie.
Frenchie. What a great name.
Frenchie. We don't know what the real name is. It looks like a giant jar of French's mustard. And it's something that everyone can relate to, because French's, you know, is an American mustard icon. And when they see this big jar of French's life-size, everyone wants to just hug him because he's kind of huggable and get pictures taken with him. That's probably the number one attraction.
That's terrific. And Barry, if I could ask you just to back off your phone just a bit.
Sure.
You're getting a little fuzzy. But the Frenchie life-size mascot from French's. And I wondered if companies like French's or other manufacturers, do they show any kind of interest in what you guys are doing?
Absolutely. French's and Grey Poupon are major sponsors of the National Mustard Museum. We also have an extensive Grey Poupon exhibit telling the entire story of Grey Poupon. So it is an important part of how we survive. We also have National Mustard Day, which is celebrated annually the first Saturday in August. And French's and Grey Poupon and other mustard companies support that great family-friendly festival.
I want to talk about promoting your hobby and your museum, kind of going back to what we talked about a moment ago. How did you promote the Mustard Museum? Did you advertise? Did you make speeches? Tell us about how you got the word out.
Well, I didn't really advertise. I found that if you're doing something that's fun and different, people will find you.
Mm-hmm.
The media will find you. And writers, TV stations, people just found us, including Oprah Winfrey, who contacted us, it was about 15 years ago, and wanted us to be on her show, my wife and I. And because we were perceived, and it's true, we were very passionate about what we did, and that was the theme of her show. So we got to taste mustards on air with Oprah Winfrey. So that's the kind of thing. You just be yourself. Don't try and be someone else. People will see through that. The media will see through that. If you're yourself, the story will get out there. so we don't really spend much in terms of advertising. We're just ourselves, and people find us.
Well, thank you, Barry, again so much for being with us here today on The Collector Show. For those of you who want to check out the Mustard Museum, their website is very simple. It's www.mustardmuseum. It's all one word. And if you want to visit, it is now located in Middleton, Wisconsin, open from 10 till 5, 7 days a week, 800-438-6878. If you'd like to speak to Barry or one of his staff members personally. Coming up next, Larry Zale on The Collector Show. Please stay tuned. Well, we're going to welcome back our friend Larry Zale. Larry, of course, you remember, is the president of Lawrence C. Zale Associates, a visual arts advisory services company out of New York City. And last week, we were talking with Larry about the different types of collectors and the different levels of collecting that those folks got into. Some were casual collectors, others were considered connoisseurs. And if you'll remember, you didn't necessarily have to have a lot of money to become a connoisseur collector. So we're going to take up where we left off with our friend Lawrence C. Zale. And Larry, welcome back to The Collector Show.
Harold, thanks so much for having me.
So I want to go back to the motivations for collecting. What causes people to want to collect, and what are the types of things that those folks who are more than just casual collectors, what kinds of things do you see them having in common?
What I find fascinating about collecting, Harold, is that there's no clear definition because it takes on so many different forms. But broadly speaking, I think for the psychological reasons, that would include passion. A hoarder or an accumulator, a collector, even a connoisseur, as you suggest, have pursued objects with a great deal of dedication and discernment, almost like that of an artist in the throes of creation. And by that I mean is they make the commitment to pursuing objects that they really desire, never really finishing their collection, but are always looking for yet another object to include in their collection. Another reason besides the psychological, Harold, would be for social reasons. And this, as the name suggests, is a way in which collectors themselves can meet those that are in the art trade, or for that matter, meet other collectors. And perhaps the real underlying issue at play is to increase their own social standing. The third would be for financial reasons. We've read and heard a great deal about art as an investment and the outspring of this phenomenon through various art funds or people just buying and selling works of art with the expectation of making a fat profit,
right,
not necessarily feeling a psychological connection to the work itself. And then finally, Harold, would be for some combination of reasons. It's been my experience that collectors could find elements of their collection whereby they feel tremendously connected to it under the heading of passion. And then there are others who feel that they are acquiring a painting or an object because their intention is to quickly sell it and to make a fat profit and buy something else.
I don't have a lot of experience with flipping anything, property or collectibles or anything like that, but what I would bet is that it's very tough, and you would really have to have that level of expertise to be able to flip a collectible or turn a quick profit. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, you're absolutely right, because if you wanted to sell a painting or an object quickly, because it is by definition an illiquid asset, it would be very difficult to do so. So you need the lead time, months, probably before you'd be able to sell it.
And the other point that you make is that none of these collections or collectible items, there's never a moment with these folks where they say, yep, I'm done, it belongs to the ages, and they walk away. It sounds like that almost never happens.
That's been my experience. The collection is never complete.
So earlier in the program, I had read a story about a man in Peoria, Illinois, who was a passionate collector of baseball cards, and he had combined his love of baseball with collecting these cards, and without ever having a monetary goal in mind, ended up with a very valuable collection. Unhappily, his most valuable cards were stolen. And I remember one of the things we talked about previously was, or were, collectors who, for different reasons, did not insure their collections. And I wondered if I could ask you your opinions about the need for even casual collectors or people like this gentleman who wasn't interested in making a profit on his collection but had one that was valuable. How seriously should they consider having their collections insured?
It's a very personal matter. I guess the question to ask, to insure or not to insure a collection, and the answer lies within the person, him or herself. For the folks that I know who have collections without insurance, they're fearful of potentially being audited by the IRS, having people solicit them for business, and probably most menacingly, leaving themselves open for theft.
Right.
Many of them just prefer to keep a low profile and share their collections with a very select audience. There are others who want to have the peace of mind knowing that they are properly covered by insurance, but the major art insurance companies typically offer fine art insurance. Only recently have they begun to offer collectible insurance.
Mm-hmm.
There's typically two types of insurance. There's title insurance and property insurance. Title insurance is used to expose defective title or determine if the art is stolen or looted, whereas property insurance generally is similar to homeowner's insurance or a policy against theft or damage.
Right.
The problem with the current homeowner's policies is that they are not inclusive for collectibles because they are different than the fine arts. So what has happened is that there are companies that specialize in collectibles insurance. And I think for those in the audience who have collectibles and are convinced that they should have insurance, there are a few companies out there that they should contact and explore setting up a policy with them.
Can you make some recommendations for us? Or maybe recommendations is the wrong word. Could you tell us who they are?
Sure. I think the major fine art insurance companies are Chubb, AXA, Willis. For title insurance, it would be ARIS, A-R-I-S.
Okay.
Companies offering fine art and collectible insurance would be a company called Mini, M-I-N-I Company, and they're affiliated with AXA and American Collectors, Inc. They often insure luxury collectibles like ships, cars, and so forth.
Okay. Now, I'm a very conservative person by nature, and my inclination in this or any other kind of insurance, whether it's a collectible or title insurance or an automobile, is if there's any doubt that it might need to be insured, you should go ahead and have it appraised and then insured. Is that a fair rule of thumb, or is there something else we should have in mind?
It's difficult to say for sure that there is a rule of thumb. It's really for the collector to decide. If they're going to have insurance, then an appraisal will be needed for the homeowner's policy. One of the benefits of collectible insurance, no appraisals are generally required.
Okay. Well, for the sake of those of us who do own collections that were expensive to build, you could probably go ahead and just get your regular homeowner's insurance to cover it. But for others who have, like the gentleman in Illinois, or other folks who own other rarer, more difficult to find items, it sounds like it would be a good idea to have those appraised and insured, regardless of the tax implications. Is that reasonable?
I think so, but there are still a good many collectors, I'm afraid, Harold, who steadfastly want to avoid detection.
Well, our gentleman in Peoria was convinced that he had, and this was his word, that his collection was unfindable, and unfortunately for him, his collection was found and stolen. If I were in that boat, and God willing, someday I will be, if I had a collection like that, that I wasn't going to have insured, I don't think I'd show it to anybody, or I wouldn't let anyone other than my spouse or a close relative know about it, because it sounded to me like in the story that the people who stole it from him knew exactly where to look.
Yes.
And knew exactly what they were looking for. So unless you're just willing to keep something or these items completely under wraps, literally, maybe, and I'm not suggesting or recommending insurance, but I'm just saying if it were me, I would pay the taxes and go ahead and buy insurance.
Well, it makes good sense to me, Harold, but I'm afraid there are a good many collectors out there who would prefer to remain private. Many of them have marvelous collections that they can't even enjoy because they have it secreted in storage areas.
Yeah, that seems like such a shame. Well, for them, I wish them good luck. I hope nobody finds their stuff. And for the rest of you, if you think you need to have something appraised, you should talk to an insurance professional and get some direction from them. Larry, thanks as always for sharing with us here on the Collector's Show, and we'll talk to you next week.
A great pleasure. Thank you, Harold.